Creates Art Podcast. Interview, Iconic Composers with Emmy Ferguson. Hello, friends. This is Timothy Kim O'Brien, your head instigator for Create Art Podcast, where I bring my 30-plus years in the arts and education world to help you tame that inner critic and create more than you consume. Now, a little bit behind the mic here. I get emails and I get pitches from time to time, and one of my favorite places to get pitches from to be on the show is from Trope Publishing. We'll have their links in the show notes. But Miss Lauren Bell hands off some awesome guests to me. Emil Pandolfi is a previous guest from her. He talked about music, and he talked about playing piano, and he had a book out. And today, I have another guest from Trope Publishing. Her name is Emmy Ferguson. And she's brought her love of music and performing to audiences around the globe, sharing the stage as a flute player, singer, and composer with performers including Yo-Yo Ma, Paul Simon, James Taylor, and four U.S. presidents. Now, Emmy loves to collaborate with composers to help shape the future of music, in addition to looking back in the past, imagining what historical composers might have wanted their music to sound like. Born in Japan and raised in London and Boston, Emmy moved to New York City to study at the Juilliard School, where she is now a faculty member. And I'm going to have all of her links in the show notes. And Lauren Bell from Trope Publishing poked me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Tim, I got somebody for you because I know you like music." And I had a wonderful conversation with Emmy. She has a book coming out called Iconic Composers, which I have pre-ordered, and I did get to see a preview of it, and it's a fantastic book on composers for the past couple hundred years, and it includes women and people of color. So you're going to learn a lot. I know I learned a lot while talking with Emmy, and without further ado, here we go. So, Emmy, you've been working on this this new book, this composer's book, and you yourself, you're a musician, but I'd like to know, how was the process of taking something that's musical, talking about different composers and talking about music, and actually seeing that come to life in a book?
Oh, it was really exciting. First off, I get to work with this incredible team of people. David Lee Sisko is an incredible illustrator who made all the fantastic artwork you see in this book, and who really was the impetus for the entire book. This is part of his People series. And so this is the third book in the series, and he reached out to his cousin, Nicholas Sisko, who I met a very long time ago at Juilliard and who I've worked with a lot. And he brought me on board for this really, really exciting publication through Trope, which is a publisher out of Chicago. And it was incredibly daunting and exhilarating to imagine trying to take all of history's composers and pick only 50, and then on top of that, somehow figure out how to boil down their entire lives to 250 words that would be accessible to everybody from age 12 to age 80. So it was a task for sure.
That's true. And he's done another book, Scientist, which I do have a copy of. And I will get to interview him at a future date very soon.
Fantastic.
But yeah, the illustrations in it are fantastic. And just going through the all the composers there, it taught me a ton of stuff. And I'm an orchestra kid from high school.
Yeah, awesome.
I used to play tuba, bass guitar, baritone, the whole 10 yard. So I'm right there with you in the whole musical sphere. Not as good as you, not as good as you, obviously, but
not at all. It's the most important thing about music is that it's open to everybody. And I think that's the thing that we wanted to get across the most in this book, that like there are many different types of composers from all different places, from all different backgrounds, and they are all composers. They are all musicians, and that anybody who reads this book and feels so inspired can also become a composer themselves. All it takes is a little imagination.
That is the truth. That is absolutely the truth. I have twin girls that they loved the science book, and they're going to get this composer's book. I got, you know, a preview of it. I've got the PDF for it. They haven't seen it yet, but their birthday is in June. So,
that sounds like perfect timing.
It was a match made in heaven. Obviously, they need to read this book. With all of these composers that we have in there, and my background, I remember in orchestra, we didn't play any music that I remember, and it's been a few years, but we didn't play any music by any women or any BIPOC people whatsoever. How has the world, well, not the world, but how has the education world changed since, let's say, the early 90s when I was, in school to today? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? How are you seeing that?
I mean, I think it's a very exciting time to be a student. We have access to, especially a music student, we have access to music from all over the world. We have access to music from many centuries at this point. And that's sort of what we wanted to focus on in the book, was looking at, from the Western classical music perspective, composers from the past 1,000 years, some that you may have heard of and some that you might have heard their name but don't know too much about, and then others who might be completely brand new. And as you said, that's because for a very long time, we were hearing the stories and the music of a very small subset of our society, when in fact, people everywhere have been writing and playing music. It didn't matter what your gender, what your ethnicity was. Music is a shared human experience. And as a flute player myself, I'm quite biased because I get to play this instrument that's the oldest melodic instrument in the world. And you see it in every single civilization, in all the continents. And what that does for me is it makes me really feel that the instrument that I get to play is part of our shared cultural DNA. We all hear that sound, and it does hit somewhere like very deep inside of us, whether we realize it or not. And the voice is the same. Percussion is the same. These very, very old ways of coming together and sharing in song, in mourning, in dance, the things that are the most integral to what it means to be human. And so I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be a student and to see that there are even more ways to celebrate those things than perhaps we were taught 50 years ago or even 20 years ago.
The scientist book and the composer's book should be required reading for kids in elementary and middle and high school, because like I said, I didn't get this information when I was a kid, and I feel kind of cheated out because I enjoy a wide variety of music. Right behind me here is, my vinyl collection, and most of it is not, from the Western world. A lot of it's from Senegal and Kenya and India, and I really enjoy that kind of stuff because, like you said, there's that certain it's almost indescribable, but it's that certain commonality that all of these traditions have that you can really get into, and expanding our minds like that only improves us, only makes us better people. So Thank you for doing this book, and thank you for the work that you do. This is going to be a tough question, but it's like asking, who's your favorite kid?
Here we go.
You knew this question was coming, but out of the 50 composers that you have there,
oh my gosh,
who's the most influential one on you and your personal practice?
Wow. That is a very difficult question to answer. I would say, I will cheat a little bit and say that every single one of these people has been influential to me in some way, which is why I felt compelled to include them in the book. The composer whose music I play the most is probably Johann Sebastian Bach, a composer that might be familiar to a lot of listeners. He's somewhat omnipresent when you think about the Western classical music tradition. His music has been taken and reformatted into jazz, into rock, into pop. You hear it in movies. You hear it in the elevator. You hear it in church. You hear it absolutely everywhere. And his music is one that I think musicians of all backgrounds really appreciate for its incredible architecture. And I end up playing a lot of music where I do it on the instruments of that time period. So I'll play Bach's music on a flute that is modeled after one from the 1700s. And so because of that, I end up playing a lot of his music, and I see how much it impacts everything else that I do. So his music is quite profound. And then the other person who I would want to draw attention to is someone who's in the book, who's not a composer per se, but I believe that she really should be part of this book. And her name is Nadia Boulanger. And she and her sister are featured in this book, Lily Boulanger. Lily died very young at the age of 24, but was an incredible composer who had an incredible career ahead of her that was cut short. And when she passed away, her older sister, Nadia, really took up the baton of not only sharing her sister's music with the world, but she became what some would call the composer's advocate in the most incredible way. She has been called the most influential teacher since Socrates because she taught so many 20th century composers. And if you read this book, you'll see in many of the bios how so many of these people went and studied with her in France. And it was when they studied with her that she sort of encouraged each one of them to have their own voice and to follow their own voice. If you look at her students, it's everybody from Aaron Copland to Quincy Jones. So we've got Appalachian Spring as well as Michael Jackson's Thriller represented in her students. And I think that's incredible that this pedagogue was able to encourage every one of her students' unique voices.
That's amazing. And the reason why I asked that question is because, you know, I want our listeners to, you know, look for certain things that they wouldn't necessarily notice.
Yeah.
So I thank you for that. Definitely thank you for that. What feeling do you want people to take away after reading this book? I know for me, it was eye-opening, and I went back to my music collection, and I was like, I need to be more diverse in, you know, I already have a pretty, I think, diverse collection, but I looked at it and I said, I need to be more diverse. I need to learn more about these people that you're talking about, that you're introducing to us in 250 words, which that by itself, I'm just like, wow, I write Russian romance novels with any of the stuff that I do for work. So for you to be able to, you know, condense everything down to 250 words, it is amazing. But what do you want people to feel after they get done reading this book?
I think you hit it right on the head. Like, we want people to go and continue to find out more about these people. There's so much more about them that is not in those 250 words. And so we just really wanted to try and create a snapshot of who they were as a person and what made them really iconic in so many ways. So we really want people to go and learn more about them. We want people to listen to their music and really want people to support composers today and support the creation of new music, because without it, hey, we're not going to have this book in a couple hundred years. We need people to keep writing music, and we need people to support that, to go listen to it, to commission it, and be excited about what contemporary composers have to say.
Moving a little bit away from the book, and because you recently had a TED talk on this topic, the differences in the audience behavior from way back when to now, when I saw that, I immediately I'm here in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and we have a college here that they recently did Holst the Planets.
Oh, I love that piece.
That is, as a tuba player.
Yeah, epic.
Jupiter, Bringer of Jollity is, that's my jam right there. Mm-hmm, I'm in tears at that one. But we went as a family to go see that. They had Jordy LaForge, the guy for Reading Rainbow, forget his name. Ugh, having an old timers moment there. But he was kind of narrating it through, and then they had pictures of the different planets.
Wow.
Going through. Obviously, this is not happening in Holst's time.
No.
With the way the behavior was back then to what we've come to now, where it's, you know, very hush, very, you know, solemn and all that. What was it like back then, and how is it different than what we're doing right now?
Well, you know, back then, you know, could mean so many different points in time. If we think about even older than Gustav Holst's time, which was the early 20th century, we think back to the time of Johann Sebastian Bach, who I mentioned earlier. People experienced music in many different ways. Even Bach's music was, some of it was experienced in the church where he worked. He had a day job, so to speak, writing music for the weekly church service and teaching many young boys this, you know, craft of music making. So people could experience it in the church, which from what I gather was a little bit of more of a rowdy church going experience than we might experience today. The congregation was always involved. So he was often weaving in folk songs or very familiar hymns to the pieces so that they would be able to follow along and sing along. But he would also be found down the street at Zimmerman's Coffee Shop, which was like the local bar, local cafe, where he'd hang out with a lot of university students and fellow musicians. And they drink beer and they drink coffee and they'd play music late into the night. And so, you know, you have all these different moments. And then the fact that until the 20th century, we could not have music in our home unless we were making it ourselves. I think that's something that's really important to point out that we all definitely take for granted today, that having music made in your home was a very, very big privilege, or it was something that was shared with your family and everybody played a different instrument and sort of got together and jammed in the evenings. And that's certainly true for Johann Sebastian Bach's family as well. He had 20 children, 13 of whom lived to adulthood, and they were all musicians, as was his wife. She's a fantastic singer. And so I can only imagine what that living room might have been like when they got together to, you know, hang out and make music. And that really continues. You know, we look at someone like 19th century composer Franz Schubert, who was writing a lot of what we call art songs, songs for voice and piano that really were intended for the living room. They were intended for social gatherings. He was part of what I like to imagine was kind of like a fraternity where they'd get together, and he was the person who provided the entertainment. He provided the music. And sometimes that music was quite bawdy, and other times it was very lofty. And, you know, we see that continuing into the 20th century as well, but we start to see things become more accessible to the general public in the form of concert halls as orchestras got bigger, things got louder, and things became more accessible for regular people to go and attend. And then, of course, we have the onset of the recording industry and being able to hear recording and radio, being able to hear music in your home. What an incredible thing that must have been to experience for the first time. So we've come a long way. Things have changed a lot. And I think we could afford to do a lot more music making at home ourselves these days.
Well, and it's easier to make music at home. I mean, you don't even necessarily have to have an instrument. You can, you know, do a lot of things right on the keyboard, on your regular keyboard. I know I do a lot of electronic music when I have spare time.
Yeah,
I joke that I have spare time.
Don't we all?
So you talked about how people behaved back in some instances back in the day. When someone comes to your show, what do you like to see? What really gets you going as a performer, as an artist? What helps you out to give a better show from the audience?
Oh, well, it's impossible for us. I mean, the audience is integral to a performer. That's why it was so difficult, I think, for many musicians during the pandemic, was because we were stripped of that really, really important relationship. And for me, I love playing small concerts. I love being able to interact with my audience, whether through talking and understanding what they're feeling in the moment, but also through sort of nonverbal cues, whether that's eye contact, whether that's you can read people and see how, if they're present, if they're engaging, and what about that music is hitting them and moving them. And it can be joy, it can be anger, it can be sadness, it can be happiness, so many different things. But my goal as a performer is to make sure that when people come to my concerts, that they have an impactful experience, whatever that impact may be for them. I know how valuable everybody's time is. And it's important to me that if someone has taken that time to come to a show, that it really resonates for them. And so that's always my goal. I want them to feel once they leave that fulfilled.
Fulfilled. Excellent. So we had on previously Emil Pandolfi. And fantastic interview. Everyone go check it out. Wonderful guy. He was talking about his method of practicing. And, he has a certain way that he goes about doing his practicing. And I think we've all heard about the 10,000 hour rule. If you practice something for 10,000 hours, you'll become an expert at it. What's your practice routine, if you're preparing for a tour or a concert, maybe a one-off concert? What are you doing in your practice routine?
Oh, boy. I am someone who does not practice what I preach. I will say that. I think we all aspire to be the world's best practicers, the little children in us who so diligently listen to our teachers. Oh, goodness. But I am bad. I'm a bad practicer. First, I always use a metronome because I need a babysitter. What the metronome does is it allows me to see exactly where I've gone, where I've progressed from point to point. And so I do a lot of repetitions with a metronome. For those listeners who aren't familiar with what a metronome is, it's just a machine that like clicks and it splits the minute into different divisions. So 60 beats per minute is a second, 120 beats per minute would be 2 beats per second, and so forth. And you can get very, very sliced down there. And for me, that really just helps keep me honest and keep me focused. If I'm doing a session, and I'll often slow my pieces very, very, very far down from where I need so that I can just really drill and make sure that I am not practicing in bad habits as I'm doing it, so that the music gets into my long-term memory, past my short-term memory. But the bad thing that I do when I do that is I watch reality TV the entire time. it's not great. But what it does is it means that I actually end up practicing for hours. I've got mindless TV going on. And I'm also doing, in some ways, mindless practice that I stop myself every now and then to make sure that I am still staying as present as I can while I'm doing both things.
Understood. Absolutely.
But it's bad. I don't recommend it to students out there. That your training teacher in me says, don't do this. You need intentional practice. I'm very bad.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We'll grant you forgiveness on that, and just as long as it's not bachelorette or something like that.
That's, sometimes.
Well, that I can't dispensate that, but that's okay. Recently, we did an episode on the importance of rest in your artistic practice. I've been doing this thing called Kickstart Creativity every week for my audience. And this past week, we talked about rest. As an artist, how important does rest play into your practice?
I would like it to play a more important role. I think for a lot of artists, you know, we're very, very lucky that our passion is our job. And what that means is that you are working 24/7 because your brain is constantly thinking about, well, what about this? What about that? What about the other? So rest doesn't happen in the way that I think would make it a healthier practice. So I am trying to get better at scheduling in weeks where I am not on the road, where I'm not in rehearsals, not necessarily for rest, but so that I can have enough time to feel rejuvenated and ready to create. Because part of our jobs when we're not out there performing is to think about what else do I want to make that's going to be exciting for audiences to experience and exciting for me as a performer to engage with. So having enough presence of mind and rest to be fully ready to create is something that's very important, and I'm trying to prioritize more.
We're all works in progress.
Yeah.
Progress. I'm truly guilty about the whole rest thing because I come from Chicago. So when I saw, David Sisko and then I was like, oh my gosh, my Chicago people.
Yeah.
We have a certain, a Midwestern ethic, a work ethic. And I didn't hear about that until I moved out to the East Coast. Hmm. What's, after this book comes out, what's your next big project that you're going to be working on?
My next big project is a recording project that I'm doing in July of 2023. And this is a recording project with the group Ruckus, which is a group that I made an album in 2019 with. We did an album of Bach's Sonatas and Preludes. And Ruckus is a very unique band because they are a continual band. And basically what that is, it's a Baroque version of a jazz rhythm section. So they read chord symbols and bass lines and sort of improvise and rearrange what's on the page and really make it their own. And people like Johann Sebastian Bach, George Frideric Handel, they all wrote with this idea of continual, sometimes called figured bass, or just chord symbols and improvisation in mind. And Bach once said, no piece is finished until the performer gets their hands on it, because there's so much left to the imagination of the performer. So we really run with that. We have a really fun time with that. And this summer, we're going to do an album of music that features two iconic composers who did not make this book. And that's something that I really want to say is there's so many composers out here. This is just the tip of the iceberg. And these are two of my favorite composers who are not in this book, but are incredible. One of them is Georg Philipp Telemann, a Baroque composer. And the other one is Györgyi Ligeti, a Hungarian composer from the 20th century. And his music might be famous to people because it was used as part of the soundtrack to the movie Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, as well as many others. It's super cool. What we're going to do is we're taking two pieces or two collections of pieces, one by Telemann, which is originally for a solo flute, and we're going to imagine, we're going to compose, we're going to add parts for the six members of Ruckus, which includes harpsichord, keyboard, Baroque guitar, theorbo, which is like a giant bass guitar combo, double bass, cello, and Baroque bassoon. So we're going to add all these crazy parts to a piece that Telemann only wrote for a single Baroque flute. And then with the Ligeti, we're going to take a piece of his called Musica Ricercata, which is for solo piano. And we are going to take that and rearrange it for the group. So it's sort of taking these original ideas from both of these composers, but really throwing our entire personality onto both of them. And I think that they both would have been pretty down for it, given how they interacted not only with their music, but music of other people.
That's awesome to hear. That's, and as soon as you said 2001, A Space Odyssey, I had to do the fist bump.
Yeah.
I actually got to see it on a IMAX screen a couple of years ago. I took my steps to it, and that was just a transformative experience. That was, it was like watching the Holst the planets.
With
Geordi, and you know, seeing the planets fly on by. It was just like, wow, amazing. Yeah. Somebody needs to do that with Berlioz Symphony Fantastique.
Oh my goodness. Yes. It would be amazing.
The story behind it is just, it blew my mind. So that's one of the reasons why I really love, and I didn't know about the story until I got into college.
Mm.
And this, we had the classical music appreciation course, which didn't have any women, didn't have any, you know, people of color or anything like that in it, but that one, and it stuck with me ever since. And anyhow, yes, that's just my idea to you. If you ever do a Berlioz piece like that, you know, something like that, let me know, give me a call.
Oh yeah.
Who do you think would be most accessible for a modern audience to get into when we're talking about classical music?
That's in the book or in general?
In general.
Well, two people who are in the book that I think a lot of people know, whether they realize they know it or not, are John Williams and Philip Glass. These are two living composers. John Williams is primarily a film score composer, and listeners will recognize his music from, goodness, the list is very, very long. E.T., Jaws, Harry Potter, Star Wars, the Olympics theme song. It's all John Williams. So his music, I think, is really woven into certainly the American ear, but I think also the ear of people all around the world because of how these movies have really traveled and become part of our global community. And John Williams himself does a beautiful job of weaving in music from many different places around the world in his own music, not only from around the world, but also in the history of Western classical music. He often brings references back from many different composers. So a great thing about his music is that if you've listened to it, you're probably going to appreciate a lot of composers of the past and a lot of composers from around the world as well, because it's so visually, it just conjures up these incredible visuals so beautifully. So he's someone that I think if you haven't listened to his music in isolation, do it, because it's just as good without the visuals as it is with them. And with the visuals, wow, I mean, it brings these movies to life. And that's something that he shares with Philip Glass, who, you know, didn't start out as a film composer, but his music has been used in so many films and so many soundtracks that it feels like he was sort of one of the people who set us off on a very distinctive path in media music, and in general. If you listen to his works, you'll recognize things that sort of feel very indicative of the past 50 years. So I think those two are really, really great people to dip your toes, I should say, into classical music, and they will then inspire you because you'll hear elements of their music in so many other composers, because they themselves have been inspired by so many other composers. You could think about Philip Glass, you know, he's called a minimalist. But who is the prototypical minimalist? Well, Bach and Vivaldi, Baroque composers, they were doing the same things in their own unique ways, but same kind of core concept. thinking about harmony and how to break it apart and break it down. And so I think, you know, you'll know their music and that'll give you more appreciation for the past.
Awesome to hear. So, Emmy, where can we find you online or out in the world here, on a tour or anything like that? Where can we get more information about you?
Yeah, you can find more information about me on my website, which is www.emmyferguson.com, EmmyFergusoN. And on that website, you can also find more about the book, Iconic Composers. I have a section there that lets you dive in even more to all these different composers. We got a playlist of selections of music that Nick and I have picked to really let you hear it, because the crazy thing about writing a book about music is that you can't hear any of it. So we have a playlist there, as well as some more info. And on my website, you can also see me perform. I've got videos. There are links to my recordings, which can be found on all your favorite streaming platforms. And when I perform, I go all over the United States, and my schedule is on the website. So definitely come join us at any of these shows if you're in the area, and send me a note, tell me you're coming, and it'd be lovely to meet anyone who's there.
Absolutely. Emmy, it's been a pleasure talking with you here today. Thank you so much for being here with my audience, introducing your new book, and maybe we'll get a book two with some Berlioz Symphony Fantastique.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, absolutely. Because as I said, this is just the tip of the iceberg of how many incredible composers there are out there. So go and listen, go and just keep listening and finding even more incredible music, because there's so much to uncover.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Ms. Lauren Bell from Publishing for getting me in contact with Emmy and her new book, Iconic Composers. All the links are going to be in the show notes. And I want to thank you for taking the listen, and I'm going to encourage you to go ahead out to her website. And if she's in your neck of the woods, definitely go and see her shows live. She has a bunch of stuff up on YouTube. She has that TED Talk there on YouTube, which I thought was amazing. So definitely check out her work, her music, and then definitely check out the Iconic Composers book. It's a great birthday gift, Christmas gift, bar mitzvah gift, whatever. It's just a great gift for yourself and for your kids. And if you'd like to reach out to me, you can email me, timothy@createartpodcast.com. And I'm on all the socials, so that'll be in the show notes for you as well. And I want to encourage you to expand your knowledge, your experience, expand what you like to listen to, and go out there and listen to some music. That's all for now. So go out there and tame your inner critic. Create more than you consume. And go make some art for somebody you love, yourself. And don't forget, go listen to some great music too. Until next time.